From the House Committee on Human Services on April 29th, 2009. Thank you, committee, for being here. And we are going to open up a public hearing and possible work session on SCR 1. Keeley?
This is a memorial measure for Phyllis Beck, who was a Eugene resident and an advocate for those whose lives were affected by hepatitis C. And we have Senator Morissette and Lauren Sant of Caring Ambassadors here.
Senator, it's great to see you again. Thank you for coming to our committee to testify this morning. Proceed when ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, Lynn and Lane County. You notice I said Lynn County first. Mr. Representative from Lynn County, who is not paying
not
attention
listening.
To what's going on. Hi there.
Senator, sir, he's one of my favorite senators.
Ignoring him.
Yeah. Thank you very much for hearing this memoriam to Phyllis Beck. I've worked with Phyllis, 2001, perhaps even in 99 session, and her passion was hepatitis C. You'll hear more about her background in just a moment, but I've known her. She would be here working Senate Bill 520. If she were still with us. She passed away recently from hepatitis C. One of the most underrated, unknown diseases that we have, and it's often fatal. It affects the liver. It's common in prisons. People are not cared for adequately. She spent a lot of time in the prison, in corrections, dealing with prisoners. We're trying to raise the awareness of it. We're trying to have additional testing. It's often related to HIV, but hepatitis C in itself is deadly. And we need to, in memory of Phyllis, hopefully, we will pass a bill this time. It is in Ways and Means. The fiscal is about $260,000 plus or minus. We're going to try to get it out of Ways and Means, and in memory of Phyllis, which she gave her life for. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lauren, and you can hear some of the heroic things that she was engaged in.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Morissette. Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair, for inviting me to speak today. Phyllis Beck was one of the country's greatest advocates for people living with or affected by hepatitis C. She advocated for everyone, no matter where they came from in life or how they got the disease. It didn't matter. Phyllis was there for them. As you just heard from Senator Morissette, chronic hepatitis C is not an esoteric orphan disease. It's the most common chronic bloodborne virus in America. It is more than five times greater than HIV in our state. An estimated 5 million Americans have it, including about 65,000 Oregonians. Now, you'll notice this is every number I'm going to give you is an estimate because we have no testing and surveillance nationally or locally to be able to give you real, true numbers. These are estimates based on the NHANES data, which is a national household survey data, and that data does not include prisoners, the homeless, or anyone who is not living in a house that is not currently in the healthcare system, is not counted in those numbers. So these are all estimates, and they're conservative estimates. There is no vaccine for hepatitis C, and there's about 26,000 new cases a year currently. The vast majority of people infected with hepatitis C sustain chronic liver disease, serious chronic liver disease, before they're ever diagnosed. In fact, about two-thirds of the people living with hepatitis C are unaware of their infection. Liver's a wonderful organ. It works perfectly well till it's about 90% destroyed before it really starts telling you there's something majorly wrong there. So it's really critically important that we make everyone aware of the ongoing substantial public health threat from hepatitis C for all Americans. It leads to cirrhosis in 20 to 30% of those infected, with 10% of those leading to liver failure or liver cancer, for which liver transplantation is the only possible proven life-saving measure. A liver transplant costs $300,000 just for the transplant itself. It costs about $1 million over the lifetime of that patient. It doesn't get rid of hepatitis C. All it does is give that person a new liver and some possibly some more time to live. Treatment is only $36,000 a year, and it's 1 year, maybe even 6 months of treatment. So we're allowing people, we're wasting money by sending them to the liver transplant list. Over the past decade, you have heard about cancer going down everywhere. Cancer's going down. Well, where it's not going down is liver cancer, and that is due to hepatitis C. 41% increase in new cases and 35% increase in deaths from liver cancer in this country. Other than women with lung cancer, it is the only increasing cancer we have today, and that is due to hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is also the leading cause for a liver transplantation. We currently have 18,000 people on the liver transplant list, and yet we only perform about 6,000 liver transplants a year. Phyllis died waiting for a liver. A decade ago, the Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, said hepatitis C is one of the most significant, preventable, and treatable public health problems facing our nation, a graver threat than the AIDS crisis. Yet to date, 20 years after hepatitis C was first identified and 17 years since it was recognized as an epidemic in this country, the public health response has been virtually non-existent. Trying to address hepatitis C with our current plan is trying to fix a hemorrhage with a Band-Aid. It just will not work. We really need a significantly stronger response, and we need one here in Oregon as well. The opportunity is still there for us to change the impact. Just getting the message out about that people shouldn't drink alcohol if they have hepatitis C and getting people diagnosed can change the impact on this state and change the impact on the people living with hepatitis C, because alcohol fuels the fire in the liver and can cause someone to go to cirrhosis 9 times faster if they drink with hepatitis C. So if we could just get that message out alone, we could change what's happening with people. Most people in this state that have hepatitis C that are uninsured do not have access to care. When I do testing down at Waterfront Blues as a nonprofit organization, we offer free testing every year. We come back around 5 to 7% positive is the number of people that were testing positive at Waterfront Blues. The Center for Disease Control's estimates about 2% of the general public is positive, yet we're getting 5 to 7% positive. The problem is that's an antibody test, and to actually determine whether someone still has the virus active in their body, they need a PCR, and those are some technical terms that you don't really need to know what they are, but they're further testing. I can't send anybody, if they're uninsured, to OHSU for that PCR. They can't take them anymore. There's a 6-month wait for treatment at OHSU for someone with hepatitis C. And if you live in Eugene, or if you live in Bend, or if you live in Pendleton, you have to drive to OHSU for care, or Oregon Clinic for care. We're talking about people with a chronic disease that, if you're on treatment, it's similar to chemo. It is very difficult to drive. You shouldn't be driving, and yet we're asking our residents to drive 6, 7, 8 hours one way for that care. We have to have change here. There's about 20 to 30,000 Oregonians who do not know they are infected. Part of what Senate Bill 520 will do is implement a pilot testing program so we can start identifying those people. We have a cure. For about 50% of the people, treatment works, and it's a cure. I'm very lucky. Our organization was founded by my brother and I. My brother was diagnosed in 1999, and he is cured today of hepatitis C, I'm glad to say. But I have 3 family members with hepatitis C, and 2 of them are not cured. One could not take it, tolerate it, and the other one it was not successful in. And it was the same with Phyllis. Phyllis, unfortunately, her disease was progressed by the complications of treatment. The majority of people that are living with this disease are in the prime of their life, like Phyllis. They're 45 to 65. They're also in the prime income-earning years and our prime tax-based dollars that are coming into our state, and yet they're being taken out left and right. We need a campaign to get these people identified. The people that are at most risk need to be identified today. Imagine what it would look like if every person in this building asked their local paper to write a story about someone in their community who is living with hepatitis C. We could do a lot. We don't have to have millions of dollars. We just need to have a public education campaign and educate people that this is a disease you can prevent, and you can also stop the spread of it, and you can change the outcome of the disease for every single person living with it. No one is immune to hepatitis C. None of us. The effects of hepatitis C are substantial. $85 billion in direct medical care costs in the next 10 years due to hepatitis C in this country. So I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to recognize the work that Phyllis was trying to get done and the work that she was doing. She turned her diagnosis into a blessing. She dedicated her life to helping others. She was so special. I really miss her. It's hard to sit here without her next to me talking. And she's the first person who brought me into this building. And I worked on a national level, and she kept saying, "Why aren't you helping me in Oregon?" And she was a very special person. She did a lot for the state. She changed how the state is dealing with corrections with hepatitis C. 20% to 40% of our corrections are filled with hepatitis C. In Multnomah County, 35% of the jails are hepatitis C positive. She went in there. She opened up the education opportunities. She got the state testing. She got the state considering treatment for those where treatment was possible. She worked equally with every person she encountered. There was no stigma. There was no right. There was no wrong. There was only the human being on the other end that required Phyllis's help. She wrote a newsletter for the thousands of prisoners around the country. She also wrote a newsletter for you, educating you about what the needs were about hepatitis C, for those of you that remember that when she was still alive, keeping you informed. She founded and worked with many national coalitions, and she was respected by everyone who had the pleasure to work with her. She never stopped working to better the lives of others, and neither can we. So thank you for listening today, and in honor of Phyllis, let's get something done this session. Thank you.
Thank you for coming today and sharing your story with us. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Senator Bill. It was my pleasure to carry the bill. I don't recall the number. It might have been the same last session, or my first session. It was my first 10-minute bill-carrying speech, which I heard about repeatedly. But it was 10 minutes to the second. And I just wanted to add, everything Lauren is saying should be very sobering for us to think about, and especially people in emergency services. It's our greatest fear, because we can be immunized against hepatitis A and B, which we all are, and you all should be too, but there is no immunization for hep C. And at any time, and as I didn't know those numbers were so high of our incarcerated population, but think about those who are not incarcerated and or are about to be. It's not that they just get it in jail. So it's something that I've always feared, and it's always in the back of your mind that there is no immunization for, which I find terrifying.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions or comments? All right, thank you. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morissette, for coming, presenting this to us.
What's that Senate bill number again? 570, she said.
Lauren, what was the Senate bill number?
520.
520, thank you.
Last 2 years ago, it was 769.
You're good. I used to be good with numbers.
2 years before that, no.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this resolution? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing portion and open up the work session on SCR 1.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Boone moves SCR 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Deborah.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Excused.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Van Orman.
Excused.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, SCR 1 is adopted. And Representative Boone, would you like to carry this on the
floor? Sure, and I promise I won't do a look at this. I would be honored.
Can connect with Ways and Means on this?
The Senate bill that was...
Okay.
That's the Senate bill they were referring. This is just the memorial.
Right.
I would be happy to.
Great. With that, I will close the public hearing on SCR 1 and open up an informational hearing on HJR 45. Representative? Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Boy, there's a team.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
What was that? don't want to share it with the full committee?
Oh, several of us heard. This is an interesting team we're looking at.
And for good reason. And I hope you'll understand when we're finished today. For the record, representatives, my name is Matt Wingert. I represent House District 26. And what has brought us together on this bill, Representative Shields and I, is a belief that we need to promote fatherhood and fathers' involvement in families. And we believe that that has critically positive outcomes for children and all sorts of social policies that we're all trying to address as legislators. And because I think that the wording of the resolution is so critical, and that this is information that I think most people don't fully understand yet, I'd like to read it. Whereas babies as young as 3 months of age can distinguish between their mother and father, and whereas children with involved fathers score higher on cognitive tests, and whereas improved cognitive ability is associated with higher educational attainment, and whereas father involvement lessens the likelihood of at-risk children failing or dropping out of school, and whereas children with involved fathers experience enhanced career success leading to higher incomes and greater financial stability, and whereas children with involved fathers demonstrate lower rates of teen violence, delinquency, and other law enforcement problems, and whereas father involvement is associated with positive child characteristics such as empathy, self-esteem, self-control, psychological well-being, social acceptance, and life skills, and whereas having an involved father provides a role model for positive parenting, healthy caregiving, and commitment to the family, now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we declare that it is legislative policy to support fatherhood and to further children's well-being by enhancing the bonds between children and parents through providing children maximum access to their fit and loving parents regardless of the current marital status of the parents. And my two fellow testifiers today are going to talk a little bit more in detail about that, but this is an extremely important public policy issue. It matters in all of the other things that we're spending money on social policy in this state, and it is, in my opinion, probably the one thing that we can do that would have the most dramatic positive results in all of the negative social outcomes that we're having to pay for and to fund to try to treat out in society as a result. We seem to be very clear as a society that children need to have their mothers. I think we have that. Intuitively, the vast majority of us seem to understand how critical that is for children to have their mothers. But I don't think as a society that we are convinced yet that children really do need their fathers as well. And the point of this resolution was simply to try to help further that goal of helping us all as a society to understand that we really do get the best possible outcomes for children when they have both their mother and their father actively involved in their life. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Madam Chair. No co's in the substantive committees. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent District 43, Inner North and Northeast Portland. And I'm here to support House Joint Resolution 45, what I consider to be a father's responsibilities resolution. As some of you may know, I started an organization in North and Northeast Portland called Better People, which is a living wage employment and counseling program for adult probationers and parolees and people who are in recovery from addiction. And I've also been very much involved in the Mayor's Gang Task Force in North and Northeast Portland. And what my experience, and I think the literature shows clearly, is that a lot of the problems that we have in our criminal justice system is the result of absentee fathers or antisocial fathers who are not fulfilling their responsibilities. And my experience in working with women in the criminal justice system is that very, very frequently they are get involved in the criminal justice system, often because of the antisocial men in their lives who weren't fulfilling their pro-social obligations and responsibilities. And so, and I think as a fellow social worker, Madam Chair, we know that in the literature around outcomes for kids, you have a body of literature that says, you know, we need to ameliorate risk factors and incorporate as many protective factors as possible in a kid's life. And protecting loving parents are a critical piece of that. And so I'm here in support of House Joint Resolution 45 to encourage fathers to step up and fulfill their responsibilities and celebrate those who do. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Minahan.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here. My name is Matt Minahan. I represent Dad's America. I represent fathers, but I think it's also important to point out that not only do I represent fathers, but I represent families and children, and fathers are a component of that family structure. In fact, we just had testimony on another bill at another committee where we flew in Dr. Fabricius from Arizona State University. He presented some fantastic research that shows the benefit of the father's relationships and actually the long-term physical effects that it can have on children. And I think it's also to point out, I've testified over the years on many issues, on restraining orders, family plans, visitation, and it always seems to be, and I've always said in my testimony and every time I've testified that the father's issue isn't necessarily a men versus women issue. In fact, a third of our membership in Dad's America are women. I spend a lot of my time, I take calls every day from fathers, soldiers who come back from overseas, who are some of the bravest people I've ever met, who are actually in tears and crying because they can't see their children that day, or fathers who have gone through the system and have family plans and that aren't being adhered to and are really upset and can't see their children. I do think that the system is slanted against fathers. Now, I'll point out that I am biased. I get the calls that from fathers that when the system isn't working, if it is working well, they're probably not calling me. But you know, these victims are you know, wanting to see their children and can't, and we understand the importance of that. And I've been around long enough to remember the deadbeat dads photos that we had, and I think we fight that kind of perception, and we fight the perception of, well, fathers are the breadwinners, and they are maybe not wanting to see their children, and I think they get beat down so bad. The perception is that they don't want to see their children, and what makes me sad is that they do. I represent fathers who do, and you know, changing that certainly, you know, will be a struggle. But I think this message that we send out, saying that fathers matter and fathers are important component of the family structure would be very valuable and say more than I think we could you would imagine, and it would mean more than you could imagine to fathers in the state of Oregon. And I appreciate the time that you guys give us to get that message across.
Thank you, Mr. Minahan. Okay. Any questions of anyone in this panel? Representative Maurer, does that say you want to ask a question?
No, I just say, aren't fathers cool?
Yes, fathers are really cool. Absolutely. Well, good. Thank you so much for coming.
Madam Chair, it was interesting to follow some of the movement that occurred in the 1990s, and actually there's still some movement across the nation that dealt with promise keepers. But the focus on that was really what these three gentlemen are talking about, wanting to, you know, fathers step up to the plate, be responsible for where you're at. And I mean, I appreciate you guys bringing this forward.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I also follow that movement. I was heavily involved in my own court battles at that time, so I was very sensitive to all issues related to that in the 90s. And I do think that it's extremely important that we work on sending the message to young men that they need to take responsibility for the children that they create, and to be as involved in their lives as they can, and to make the sacrifices that are necessary, both financially and of their time, to be present for their children. I think, though, that it's also important from a public policy stance that we accommodate that when that desire is there, that we have a legal structure, and more than that, a public policy structure and just a societal structure that says to men when they do want to step up that they're welcome into the process and that they will be treated fairly and that we want to encourage them to take responsibility for their children. And I think, unfortunately, what happens sometimes is that men get the sense that they're not as welcome into the family court system or into the structure, and they take that cue. Unfortunately, and become discouraged and I think in some cases give up or walk away. So I think we're always going to have to combat this this problem of some men not taking responsibility for their children, but I think that it's important for us as legislators and as policymakers to make sure that nobody has the excuse of the system for why they didn't step up and take responsibility for their children.
Exactly.
Madam Chair, actually, it's not a state issue, but it's a federal issue where the system does not help fathers take responsibility, and unfortunately, it's with disabled veterans. But there is and I'm going to use a little tiny platform because I think we have a minute or two. Disabled veterans who receive disability benefits sometimes have a lot of problems, and they serve their country in great ways. But when they come back and they receive that disability check and have no other income because of their disability, that they are relieved of the responsibility of taking care of the children that they had before they left. And that's somewhat disturbing for me.
They're relieved of that responsibility?
Essentially, yes. That disability payment can't be, I'll say, garnished, for lack of a better word, to take care of the children that they had prior to leaving. And because I'm very familiar with a case in Grants Pass, which led me to explore the federal law, and this money is protected against creditors, for a number of reasons, but
against child support, is that what
against
you're
child support too, which really it does not help for those men to take responsibility for the kids that they had, and quite frankly, I think that needs to change.
Any further questions of this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today to bring this before us. And with that, I will close the informational hearing on HJR 45. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 277A.
Senate Bill 277A requires that under specific conditions, individuals with eligible medical conditions be allowed to use employee restrooms in a place of public accommodation if a public restroom is not immediately available. It exempts gas stations of 800 square feet or less and prohibits liability from attaching to the businesses or their employees for damages suffered by a customer unless the damages are a result of an intentional tort or gross negligence.
Thank you, Keely. I think we have three people who are wanting to speak on this. Can you help me with this? We have Mara Addison, Jason Cook, and Eurasia Angelato. Are you wearing clothes?
No,
yes.
Hi,
good morning.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Mara Addison, and I reside in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 277, commonly known as the Restroom Access Act, or here, the Public Accommodation Act, and also known as Alley's Law. My daughter, Lauren, was diagnosed at age 11 with ulcerative colitis. This is an inflammatory bowel disease affecting the colon and causing sufferers to require the use of a restroom at a moment's notice. As her mom, it has been difficult to watch her struggle with this disease. Having immediate access to a restroom is critical to preventing a very humiliating experience. When shopping with Lauren a couple years ago in Portland, she needed to use a restroom immediately, and she was denied access. They told us to go across the street, down the way, up the stairs to a bathroom. And that time, my daughter was lucky. She made it. But I wonder about all the other times and all the other patients who haven't made it to a bathroom. When denied an access to a restroom, a 14-year-old girl in Illinois named Allie Bain wasn't as lucky as my daughter and had a very humiliating experience and painful experience. Because of this negative event, something positive occurred. A law was created in Illinois, the Restroom Access Act, commonly known as Allie's Law, that brings comfort to sufferers and an illness that has been in the dark way too long. 2 million people in America suffer from inflammatory bowel disease. There's no known cure for these diseases, which can inflict pain and discomfort on sufferers at any time. Along with over 40 different neurological, gastrointestinal, and urological conditions, these diseases necessitate the ability to have immediate restroom access. I'm here today, not just as a mom, but to ask you for all the patients of all these different diseases to help pass a law to help thousands of people in Oregon gain the access they need to businesses, to public restrooms in businesses. Like a handicap parking pass, Senate Bill 277 requires that those who need this access carry with them and show a doctor's note or a card detailing for the restroom access. And I brought with me, when we presented this in the Senate, they amended it, and I brought the card. This is from the Crohn's Colitis Foundation. It's called the I Can't Wait card, and it's a card that says, you know, I have
to this nice young man, and we'll pass it along.
Okay, yes.
Thank you.
And also, so if you're a member of Crohn's Colitis, you can get this card. And also, I went online. It's called myibd.org. This passes that patients can get also.
Great.
Can I interrupt right there,
Senator
Mara? Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you sharing, Mara, that card. And in the bill itself, that was a little bit restructured over on the Senate side to get to where it's at on a 30-0 vote, which I, on Section 2, Subsection 3, it says the customer presents a letter from a physician.
Yes.
So how will this apply then? I mean,
it could be a letter.
Okay.
From a doctor that says I have a medical condition that necessitates the need, or the cards. I use the cards as an example.
Okay.
But any physician could say, you know, my patient has a urological condition. It doesn't have to be inflammatory bowel disease. But if they need to use a restroom and they have a true medical condition, and the card or the letter, I think, will alleviate any problem a retail establishment might have in maybe people abusing the privilege. And that's why I had to present it in the Senate sort of as an accountability type of measure.
Okay.
This way the businesses, there's no reason they should object.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following along that same
line when I look at the amendment that says a letter from a physician or an identification card that was issued by a national organization that advocates for individuals with the disease. It might be helpful to bring out, let me see how to say this, what it would take to get that identification card. In other words, it isn't just because someone asks an organization to give you one. I would assume that there's some medical verification that goes with that.
I will let Gia talk about that. She's
okay, well, if we're going to get to it, that would be great. Thank you.
And thank you, by the way. Thank you, everybody, for hearing me.
You don't have to take it out of order. I'll wait.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Gia Angelados, and I represent the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America. Our mission is to cure Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis and to improve the quality of life of those affected by these diseases. Currently, there are over 1.4 million Americans who are living with some form of inflammatory bowel disease, including over 17,000 Oregonians. These diseases can oftentimes cause a patient to have painful, unpredictable bowel movements that require the use of a toilet facility immediately. A few seconds to a few minutes is sometimes the difference between finding a restroom and having an embarrassing and degrading public experience. This law would give these patients those precious moments that they need. Currently, the card that we issue, and I submitted the membership requirements for the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, it's a $30 membership right now, and the cards are a way for us to give the patients something that they can present. It's not a law right now, but this is a little bit of an explanation of why these patients need to use the restroom. So even though they have this card, it doesn't require the store or the employee to give them that access. We don't require a medical a doctor's note to get a card. It's anybody who joins our organization. So that answers your question. And that's just as it stands now. So we may look to amend that. Although it has passed in other states as it currently is, you know, to get this card without having the doctor's note.
I'd like to add, it has passed in 8 states, it's pending in 10, and I submitted in Washington, it's about to be signed by the governor, and I think the language of their law is very similar to ours, and I submitted the Washington.
Representative Cowan?
I think I'd like to follow up on that conversation about, if you will, the requirements to get the card in some medical verification, and my thought process is around some of the conversation that's going on right now about disabled parking permits and the current conversation in the legislature about, in order to renew those, you need to have a doctor's verification that you continue to have a disability. If this becomes state law that restrooms must be made available to individuals, then it might be helpful if the organization sort of backs that up, I guess, with something that, in order to get the card, you really do have to have a medical condition that would warrant it, rather than simply paying a membership in an organization, is where my thought process is going. It's a suggestion I would offer.
Okay, one of the other card that I submitted called, I think it was Medical Condition Alert. It's a site called myibd.org, and either a physician can go on and order X amount of cards and give it to their patients, or a patient can go online. That's how they did it right now.
All right. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jason Cook. You have my testimony. I'm a senior at Lake Ridge High School this year, and I have Crohn's disease. I was diagnosed my freshman year, it was October of 2005. I was diagnosed after about 6 months of really, really difficult time, having to go through many, many tests. I was getting my blood drawn every 2 weeks or so. We started calling the nurses who drew my blood the vampires because they took so much of it. And I was multiple hospital visits. I was on my back for 2 weeks at a time with maybe a week of not being too sick. And my life became really difficult because I had gone through school and I had a rough end of eighth grade. I had a rough beginning of freshman year. And I'm here because I know that as bad as that sounds, I'm actually pretty lucky. I have a lot of friends with Crohn's disease. I know someone who she had a good portion of her small intestine taken out because of her Crohn's disease because it got so bad. And she can't eat certain things like lettuce and tomatoes, things that are tough on your intestines. And I'm here, again, because I know that I'm lucky that I'm okay now. You know, I'm a functioning high school student. I'm going to college next year. I'm pretty active. I came down here just fine. But I want to make sure that nobody else has to have the problem like Allie had, like Lauren might almost had, and like countless of other people across the nation, especially across the state, had. Crohn's disease, one of the problems with Crohn's disease and other forms of IBD is that not very many people know about it because a lot of times it seems like it's a really, really bad stomach ache. And so a lot of people live with that without knowing that they have it. And what's so great about this bill is that it's going to the state legislature and it's going through multiple state legislatures and it's raising awareness. It was recently on the front page of the Oregonian that, you know, a little blurb about the, by the time was Senate Bill 277, now it's into the House. And again, I just really want to thank you guys for looking through this bill and really considering it. And I'm here because I know that this is an important issue. It's an important issue to me, and it's an important issue to many people across the state and across the country that we help people that could have that problem, because I might not have had a problem like Allie or Lauren did yet. Crohn's disease can come back at any time. I can have a bad flare-up at any time. I just got over one a couple weeks ago. So I don't want to have to deal with this, and I don't want people that I know to have to deal with this, and I don't want anybody to have the problem of not being able to go to the restroom when they really, really need it because of this disease. Thank you.
Any questions of either of these witnesses? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, it's not a concern. The question is, in other states, have you seen abuse of this? Quite frankly, Crohn's disease is very debilitating, and it gets, as you get older, it gets even more debilitating. But I unlike the disabled parking, I'm not quite sure that you're going to flash around your bathroom access card.
Right.
I wouldn't quite put it in the same
category. I haven't heard of any abuse of it, and I'm very we're very close to Allie Bain and her mom, who created the law, and they're actually trying to get it federal now. But we've heard of no abuses, no complaints from businesses, and hopefully, you know, outside of someone who might be indigent, you know, I don't see an abuse in a retail establishment.
No.
At all. And it just would allow, I think, a lot of humiliating experiences not to occur.
And follow up, Madam
Chair.
And my understanding, Jane is not going to testify. Jane Netboy in the back. She's not. And you
I
have a.
With them.
Okay, you have a great advocate in the back of the room, and I just want to commend her for her advocacy of this issue.
Absolutely. I'm in touch with Jane Netboy every day.
Okay.
And she's been instrumental in making sure you guys hear all about this. And she's advocating for a wonderful cause.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gia Armara, again, I'm going back to the Senate bill that was passed, and it's over here. We're looking at right now with 277. And there was a little change here from what the original bill is, from what I recall. It deals with, again, Section 2. This is Sub 2, where this section does not apply to gas stations.
Yes.
Now I'm thinking to myself, I used to work in a service station for many, many years, and honestly, I do remember, you know, Jason, the folks struggling with this back then. You know, and what came about, because I was not privy to that conversation, why gas stations were...
I don't actually know the history of the gas station, you know, when it first started. It's 800 square feet. I'm not sure why. Maybe because gas stations are more accessible, because you can pull over and you're usually not denied access. That would be my thinking.
Okay.
Do you know any history of that?
No. They didn't. At the last hearing, they didn't mention anything about gas stations, so that's actually the first time I've heard about it.
Interesting.
Okay. We'll have to do a little bit of homework then.
It seems to be written in the laws across the nation, the gas station piece.
I'm sorry, what?
It seems to be written in the laws in the states where it has passed that they put in the gas station piece, and my only guess is because it is accessible normally, whereas a retail establishment like a clothing store may not be.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask that same question, too, but I wanted to say it just seems like it's just common kindness, you know, if someone
Absolutely.
Asks. I've worked in retail outlets a lot when I was in high school and college, and I can remember people coming in, you know, moms with little kids just desperate to get them on a potty, you know, and I know that's not the same thing, but this kind of in that, and I have heard of people being turned away, and maybe that is the problem, they just don't say that, but... My dad had Crohn's disease, too, so I know how hard
it
is.
So you understand. With Allie Bain, who started this, she had the experience of all places in an Old Navy in Chicago, and she was denied. She was in horrible pain, crying, bent over. She was with her mom. She was 14 years old, and they denied her access, and she had a very bad experience. And they were so angry and so sad that they went to their state legislature, and that's how this whole thing started. But if you go into Old Navy now, across the nation, there's bathrooms there for you, me, and everyone to use. Isn't that amazing? So I was really pleased that, you know, and Allie's cause is, you know, one person can really make a difference. And it's written in her, I submitted her testimony that she used in Illinois.
I see that you've brought us from the state of Oregon their house bill. And it was read the first time February 11th of this year. Do you know if that passed?
State of Washington, I submitted?
Yes. State of Washington.
In the Washington one?
Correct.
Did I submit? Yes. It went through the Senate, the House, and the governor is about to sign it.
So I am wondering why that wasn't used sort of as the model bill for Oregon. It seems to be... It talks about what happens with the first violation.
Madam Chair, I can answer that.
Okay, Jane, you're welcome to come on up. And it says that the Department of Health shall develop a standard electronic form that may be signed by a health care provider. It just seems to be more detailed, and I'm wondering why that wasn't used as the model.
For the record, Jane Netboy. The reason that wasn't used is this 277 came out of the Senate Judiciary Interim Committee. Chris Garrett was willing to introduce a bill for us using the Washington bill, but by the time we got to Chris, 277 had already been printed, and it was in Senate Judiciary, and we just told Senator Prezansky to proceed with 277.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Netboy. Colleagues, if you have a chance to look at that.
Madam Chair, my only concern would be if the electronic form is the cost. Is the state required to create the form?
The Department of Health will develop it.
Fiscal.
You're right.
And the form is already available online. I mean, the one that would be acceptable, and it would be reinventing the wheel, in my view.
What I'd like to do, colleagues, is sort of compare the two and maybe come back and do a work session, see if we might want to amend this to include some of what maybe Washington State has incorporated, if we can do this without a fiscal.
That's concerning.
Pardon?
Madam Chair, that's the concern. I
sure.
wouldn't want to do anything that allowed it to now have fiscal.
Right.
To die.
Yeah, that's true. So that doesn't mean that we will not be passing. It's my intent to pass something here, but I guess I'd like to spend a little more time looking at Washington State's legislation and see if we can improve on the one that's been passed in the Senate Judiciary.
I'm a little confused. It was in the Senate. The Bill 277 didn't they use the language from Washington, or they did not?
Do you not have Washington State's language?
I have Washington's here.
Right, yeah.
But
Jane, you know you cannot speak from the back of the room.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So the bill that went through the Senate did not use the Washington language. They just had their original language, just so I'm clear. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It looks like we're going to be probably getting out early today. Mm-hmm. I would most definitely be willing to sit down, if they have the time to sit down.
Sure.
And just review both of them really quickly and come back here.
That's terrific.
Sure.
But you mean come back today?
No.
Oh,
no, I mean,
right. You're going to spend time with them now and then come back at a later meeting. Or 5:30.
Do you want me to come back at 5:30?
No, I don't want to see you at 5:30.
Matt?
Yes.
Actually, there is a concern here.
Okay.
And on line 18, page 1, where it says a letter from a physician.
Of
our bill, Senate Bill 277.
Okay.
Line what?
Line 18.
Okay.
The customer presents a letter from a physician in Oregon. I would suggest that you want to use a more broad terms, a healthcare provider,
Nurse practitioner,
physician assistant.
Right.
So you're not limited to physician.
That's a good point.
Because that position is very narrow.
Right. And frankly, I have a little problem with this, a national organization. I mean, that is so broad that it makes me somewhat uncomfortable. It doesn't even identify the national organization. It just says a national organization.
And Madam Chair, I would suggest that maybe LC would not want to put in. I don't know if you can put in the name of a specific organization. That may be.
Well, that
we have a lawyer on the panel
that advocates for persons with eligible medical conditions. So maybe that's sufficient.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would just like to clarify that I wasn't objecting in any way when I talked about some perhaps more, I don't know, medically related validity to the card. I'm more interested in making sure that it would be readily accepted by businesses. I'm very much in sympathy and in support of this direction. I wasn't meaning it to be narrowed or anything like that. I want the person that sees it to say, oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
And let's give ourselves credit, Madam Chair, that the House Human Services Committee is very detailed, and we take a lot of time to work. Maybe, I don't want to disparage our colleagues, but
I think they were very busy. They were trying to push
through
a lot of
bills. We're very detail-oriented
here. We are. So thank you for saying that, because we are very invested in this bill, and we will pass something. We just want to make sure that it does exactly what it is that you want it to do.
I understand. Right. Thank you.
And to kind of support what Representative Maurer said too, Madam Chair, we tend to be a little bit more friendlier than judiciary folks.
Oh, really?
May I say something?
Of course you may.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to say that once the bill is passed, the CCFA is going to do everything we can to build the awareness with the businesses here in Oregon so that they understand the bill and know about it so they aren't surprised when someone comes in with the card. So
good.
We'll do our best to
That's
do that.
A very important aspect. Good. Thank you. Jane, I know you're just wanting to speak, so come on up.
Well, I would...
Jane. Announce yourself, please, Jane.
Jane,
sit down.
For the record, you might want to talk to Ann Johnson, who is
Senator Berger's LA office manager and everything else, because she does have the disease, and she has gone through problems in stores trying to get into facilities.
Okay, good advice. So did she testify at the Senate?
No.
Okay.
And she was going to testify this morning, but Ways and Means is leaving, and she's trying to get her mother ready to go to Bend at the minute.
Right. Thank you, Jane. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for bringing this issue to us, and we'll make sure that we'll take good care of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. With that, we will close. I just opened a public hearing, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 277A. Representative Olson, you're going to be meeting with these folks right now.
Yep.
Come up with a great bill.
They're well
organized.
Okay. Absolutely.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Any other business for today? Are you asking someone else to join you?
Just curious if Representative Maurer would.
That would be great. With your experience with the medical community, that would be terrific.
That's good. Idle hands.
Idle hands.
Idle hands, that's right.
Mr. Mischief, Representative Mischief Maker.
Right.
Committee meets at 8:30 on Friday morning, not 8 o'clock.
And no meeting on Monday, right?
No meeting on Monday.
We
my understanding
have floor
is
session,
Friday.
Pretty early on Monday.
Over
and
here.
From now on, unless you will be told otherwise, I think our meetings will be at 8:30 in the morning. And let's see, I've invited Dr. Mel Cohn to come and give us
an update
on the swine flu. And when will that happen?
That will be Friday.
Friday.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Cohn.
And I appreciate you doing that. I had literally stopped someone from the department out in the hall because I had been contemplating doing some kind of a public hearing in emergency services more from the direction of the planning and such that's in place for the potential for a pandemic, but also in terms of reassurance that that's not where we are at this point. So I appreciate an opportunity to listen to Dr. Cohn in this committee on Friday, and then if there's anything that comes out of that that we need to carry on into the discussion from the emergency services ends of things, I'll be happy to take that on to a second committee.
Terrific. Great. Good.
Madam Chair, also an announcement. The 22nd of, it's in this committee, so there, you don't have to write it down. The 22nd of May, on a Wednesday, we have special guests that are, it's an informational hearing on from the Netherlands regarding their medical cannabis program. They have a Ministry of Medical Cannabis, and they are on an American tour. They will be in Washington, D.C. first, going to California, talk to the Legislative Assembly there, and then they are coming up here. And so we are arranging several meetings to include informational hearing in this committee.
Great. Thank you for arranging that, Representative Maurer. Any others? Representative Boone.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Maurer, have they left the Netherlands yet?
No, they have. Well, I don't believe they have. No, because they're 22nd of May. They're going to be here in the United States, I think,
could
for 2 weeks.
Could they bring me some spiced Leiden cheese from Amsterdam, please?
I'm afraid
you can only
they
get
bring
it.
Stop right there.
Only get it at Schiphol, because in those little travel packs, you know. Sorry. Had to do it. He's just so fun to tease.
Anything else? Very good job. Very good job this week. Committee. Very good job. All session. I appreciate your...
You still love me, Madam Chair?
I still love you.
Awesome. Awesome.
Please, please.
Oh, please. Oh. We'll learn to love you, too. Thank you.
Can we have an introduction?
Yes, please introduce yourself to the committee.
All right. Well, my name is Keith Bassett. I've been assisting in the Workforce Development Subcommittee of House Business and Labor, and it's my pleasure to come assist this committee.
Welcome. Thank you. We're so happy to have you.
Representative Dimbro and I are used to Keith. So
are you?
He's a good guy.
Good. Good.
Happily.
Okay. Any last words? Thank you, committee, and we'll see you on the floor. Close.